Welcome to Info Nation, University of Illinois at Chicago's very own podcast, created by students for students. At Info Nation, we discover how media, information, and communication are created, governed, and used. Produced by upper-level students in the Department of Communication, Info Nation brings academic research to help make sense of our increasingly mediated society. We go to the library so you don't have to.
What comes to mind when you hear the word internet?
As an easily accessible way to gather information.
With the internet, I think of all the opportunities for communication.
I would say openness.
When I think of the word internet, I think of the ability to find any information that I need.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to Info Nation. My name is Tress Kasich, and I'm a senior communications major and earth and environmental science minor at the University of Illinois at Chicago. I will be your host for today's program. Today we will be exploring the physical layer of the internet. Oftentimes the image of the physical internet components is lost in our minds. Typically we do not think about the internet as this tangible thing, as you heard from the students responding in the beginning of this podcast. We often do not see all the hardware, wires, and cables that work together to bring us our internet connection. Today we'll be focusing on the components of the internet, and one component in particular that most people may not be aware of. In the depths of the ocean lies miles of thick underwater cables that connect whole countries with the internet.
Okay, I'm here today with Paul Gasich, who is a low-voltage electrical engineer. You can just give the listeners a little bit of background as to your cable industry ties.
Okay, I started in the industry about 25 years ago with Illinois Bell, which turned into Ameritech. And then we started my own business and currently working for another company as an electrical engineer for pre-sale support. My interest in fiber was at the infrastructure of it back 25 years ago when fiber was just being put in and installed. So I can give you a little bit of insight how it evolved over the time.
Okay, so you have quite a bit of experience. So can you describe what the internet cables are made of, the submarine ones?
Yes. All these fibers are going to be a single-mode fiber. If you don't know what single-mode fiber is, there's two types of fiber. One single-mode, and the other is a multi-mode fiber. Multi-mode fiber generally is used within buildings or infrastructures of businesses, schools, hospitals, hotels, within the building. Then you have single-mode, made for long-haul transmissions. Single-mode fiber is generally between 8 and 9 microns. Multi-mode fiber is just around 50 to 62.5 microns. Single-mode fiber, as far as using it for outside applications underwater, a lot of it is proprietary to manufacturing, but the simple makeup of fiber would be a fiber in a tube, so picture a straw that's much, much smaller, about an eighth of an inch in diameter, packed with about 15 or 20 fibers that are the size of your hair. And within this little tube, it's called buffer tubing, all these fibers exist, which are basically color-coded by just a thin layer of dye when you manufacture the fiber. And within this tube is some kind of water-blocking material, whether it's dry water-blocking material or an active gel. Sometimes they'll put yarn in there to absorb. It's called water-blocking yarn or tape. And then around that, you're going to have some kind of a polyethylene, XLPE-type jacketing. Out on the outside of that, you'll have some kind of strain member. They generally use some kind of a Kevlar or some kind of high-strain yarn. And once again, since it's outdoor, they'll use some kind of water-blocking material within the yarn. So if water does penetrate at that point, the yarn will absorb it. Next to that, you'll have some kind of a corrugated or aluminum mylar shielding, light shielding on that. Another layer of a PVC, some kind of a polyethylene, depending on the manufacturing. Then within a PVC, they'll put in some kind of straight member, generally stainless steel or some kind of a metal. And then around that, they'll put another armored cladding, which would be made up of possibly small, maybe eighth of an inch thick wire all around it, wrapped around it for giving it strength and durability. Extrude aluminum polyethylene over that to seal everything off. People make it to give it strength and longevity. A lot of it is top secret. manufacturing processing, especially for the government. They don't want you to know what it's made of. It's privately owned cables, too, and everyone wants to beat everyone to the dollars.
There's a lot of components that make up these really heavy, thick cables. So as I was doing some research, I have seen that they basically are the infrastructure of the internet. True, are these cables that central to the internet?
Yes, very much so. It ties to the outside world and the outside world to us. It brings businesses together. A business on the other side of the world can set up and work just like they'd be sitting next to you.
So you have these cables on the ocean. Where do they lead to from there? So let's say we have a cable that goes from Africa to the United States. How are we connected to that cable?
Well, it depends on the vendor, who so owns it and who supports that cable. Someone puts the investment out to bury this cable, they're charging you like a toll to use that cable. You'll pay for a bandwidth, or the amount of bandwidth you choose to pay for to cross the ocean with your data. Once it gets from our house to somewhere else and from here to New York and from New York to England, people are being charged for that.
You know, I live in Chicago and I'm logging onto the internet. How is my internet being connected from my house ultimately to the undersea cable?
Well, you're going to go from your house through your modem, through your carrier, which would be Comcast. And Comcast will use the infrastructure of the highway within the network to go from point A to point B. Let's say if we go from our house to Comcast, they got a place in, say, Naperville, and that's where our server sits for us. And then from Naperville, they make ties taking that transmission to New York, to their next hub. And then from New York to overseas, you're going to get on that pipeline. Someone ultimately owns the rights to those, and Comcast may be paying a slight fee to somebody to use their network to get across.
And so from my research, I have realized that these are something that people don't really talk about. Another part I'd like to talk about is the environmental impacts of these cables. I have done a lot of research and have found out that these cables emit electromagnetic fields. Have you heard of anything in relation of sharks or any other marine life being affected from these electromagnetic fields?
Back in the old days, you had copper, so you were sending actually an electrical signal across the ocean. Nowadays, we're sending light. Cable itself, what we're transmitting is light. It's non-conductive. Back in the old days, with the copper, it had electromagnetic fields around the cable from the transmissions that would draw the sharks. Nowadays, you don't have that. They do send pulses of electricity down the cables periodically to locate them, because if we have a cable that is actually made of in-earth material, we can't find it. So what they can do is send a signal across this cable so they can find it. Basically a tracer, I should say. They used to leave them on. Nowadays, they don't. They turn them on only when they need to. But I think with the fiber we have, environmentally, you're much better off. There's no electrical magnetic field around these things. It's basically light being transmitted.
No, it was light. I always thought it was something more than light. Lastly, I'd like to talk about is when I was trying to do research for this project, one thing I ran into was a huge problem for me was that nobody wanted to talk about what these cables are made of. They didn't want to talk about the environmental impacts. A lot of reaching out to people who didn't really give me clear-cut answers. Oh, in fact, I got a lot of this information is classified, and I'm very curious as to why this information is so important.
Once again, all these cables, most of them are made private. A lot of them are government cables. We'll never know what they're made out of. They're 10 steps above us. Privately, it's competition. Your cable doesn't fail and someone else's are having a hard time. No one wants to give out exactly how that cable's made. They're going to give you idea how it's made. The only people are going to know it's the designers and the people that built it.
Do you think they do that for security reasons?
Well, government security reasons, privately competition reasons. Everyone wants to make a better cable than everyone else. They don't want to give their trade secrets up on making.
No, I also saw a story recently about the Russians being near the submarine cables. Do you think that it expands from the competition market and goes into people spying on other governments, like a matter of national security?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's been going on for as long as cable has been in the sea. I mean, we did it to the Russians, so why wouldn't they do it us?
And once again, I didn't think that these cables would be so highly guarded, but I thank you for our conversation, and thank you for being on our podcast today.
Thank you.
My second guest for today is marine biologist Alyssa Fassett. She studied marine biology along with biology at the University of Tampa in Florida. She currently works for the Florida Aquarium as assistant biologist. Thank you for being here today. What are the environmental effects of marine life on the submarine cables?
So as far as the environmental effects that the cables play on animals and whatnot, what I could find about it is that there's the potential for these cables to be emitting EMF, electromagnetic fields, and chondrocheans, which are sharks, skates, and rays, have a very sensitive set of organs called ampullae of Lorenzini. What these do is they can detect all these magnetic fields. So if there are cables that are emitting electromagnetic fields and these sharks can detect them, you can either possibly deter them from going towards them or attract them, because these mechanisms were built in sharks to be able to find prey that might be sick or dying and easy targets to eat in. So that's one of the things that is potentially there with the cables to sharks. Another thing that cables could potentially be doing is actually giving a place for organisms to grow on. So things such as anemones that need a hard substrate to develop on. When they are first born, they're little planula, which are like float around looking for some place to settle. And once they find a hard substrate, they can attach and become polyps and grow into the anemones that we know what they look like and everything like that. But in these areas where there's a lot of silt, they cannot. So when a cable's down, then they go ahead and attach and grow into big anemones. So that's kind of like a positive thing that they could have.
And they have no effects from the electricity on those?
That has not been said anywhere, so I don't know their key because of any components of the cables, but
I don't know.
There's just no data on it. The last thing that I can think of that could be a problem is that when these cables are getting put down or taken up, it's causing siltation. So just how dredging or crawling can just kick up sand and whatnot. When the sand falls back down and settles, it can be settling on top of plants or even the small organisms like anemones that are filter feeders, and causing them either to, one, not be able to get sunlight to create their own food, or getting into their gills and feeding mechanisms, and it would be breathing in sand or dust, how a human would have issues, and it would be irritant. We figure these animals and plants are having the same issue, but underwater.
Yeah, these caves are great depths, 2,000 kilometers, I think is the average. I just can't imagine all that settling down. That would take a long time.
Yeah, and you figure, I don't know how they put it down, but if it kicks it up, then it's got to come down still. So
it's true.
Expecting something.
Another thing I was reading was that it might affect their navigation system when they're migrating or they're just traveling.
That would go back to the EMFs and fish or turtles or anything else that uses magnetic fields to figure out where they're going. So if you have some other magnetic field being promoted out of the environment, then it can be confusing to them. Or, how I said earlier, with the attraction or deterrent, if an animal normally has this pathway and they're trying to get from point A to point B, and now there's this block that they don't want to go through, they have to figure out another way to get around it or over it, or just re-navigate a pathway that's been there for thousands of years that species has been figuring out getting from point A to point B.
So
fish can also be affected by it too. It's more common with chondrocheans species because they have more sensitivity to EMFs, but any of the teleosts, which are bony fish, they have some modified receptors to magnetic fields and whatnot, so there's the potential for them to be affected as well.
One thing I was curious about was the shark bite study by Lewis. The sharks, I'm assuming deep water sharks are biting these. Does it affect them when they bite it?
It could. If there's any substance in there that they shouldn't be eating, then once they're digesting it, be a problem, just like if your dog ate something he's not supposed to. Overall, the sharks will lose their teeth from it getting stuck in there, but they have rotating teeth, so no matter if they lose a tooth, they just have rows and rows coming back replacing it. But there is the potential too that, again, they think that these EMFs are promoting a low frequency type signal, like a hurt fish, and they think it's a prey, so they can go for it and bite it. I haven't read much about any effects on them, but the potential is there if there's any types of chemicals.
So another thing I wanted to talk about too was, as mentioned, I had a very hard time getting a hold of people, and even in the academic world, there's not much of a conversation that's happening around these environmental effects. Do you think there's a reason why, or any thoughts on why?
I think that since they are so important to our communication long distance, that if there was any negative effect, there'll be so many people trying to override it, showing the positive effect of communication, that we're going to shadow down and play down any of the problems. Be like, oh no, we need this, this is why. There's also not a whole lot of research that's gone into it stating if there are negative effects. A lot of the things that I read, if they're saying that, okay, siltation is happening from putting them down, they're saying, oh, it's not as bad as dredging, it's not as bad as trawling. Well, even though it's not as bad, there's still something bad going on. It shouldn't be there. It's just one more step in the wrong direction, but not the worst step, and therefore it's not getting as much attention.
I was just really surprised that they supposedly it's very minimal effect. That's what I read. There's a study on glassy sponges, and they said there was a 0.2% loss of total sponges. Like you said, they're actually helping them rather than hurting them. I was just really surprised that was there.
Yeah, it depends on the species, because, like I said, that if they can put it down and in their siltation, then it can potentially kill off animals. But once that line is down, you're creating a new ecological niche that wasn't there, and opportunistic species are going to come in and take over and start growing. So initially you're going to have a loss of biomass, but then you're going to have a regrowth in a way that wasn't potentially there before. So it's kind of good and bad, but it's not natural.
Thank you. It was very nice talking to you. I appreciate all your input.
Not a problem. Glad to help.
Thank you so much for tuning in and listening to InfoNation, coming to you from the University of Illinois at Chicago's Department of Communication. Our theme music was created by Sean Risby, a 2015 communications graduate. We hope we piqued your interest and you learned something new today. Please feel free to engage by rating, commenting, or sharing our episodes. Have a great rest of your day.